In the matter of State versus Green and Lewis, may we please have appearances of counsel? Welcome, counsel. Ms. Paskowitz, please.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court, the state respectfully requests that it be permitted to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
That's fine.
Thank you. They can solve this whole problem by giving her privilege. I'm not even sure why we're arguing this right now. If she wants to invoke the Fifth, give her privilege. You can order her to testify, and she will. Upon this unequivocal representation from counsel for state's witness Ethel Green, grandmother of defendant Carrie Green, made 6 days before trial, and with the trial court's order that she testify and an immunity petition from the Office of the New Jersey Attorney General in hand, the state referenced Mrs. Smith's anticipated testimony during its opening statement on January 21st, 2015. When called to testify at trial, Mrs. Smith ultimately elected to refuse to be sworn and testify and to spend 24 days in jail rather than testify about Green's admissions to her regarding his role in the shooting death of Eddie Baker on July 16th, 2010. This honorable court must reverse the appellate division's factually and legally unsupported extension of State versus Land to the case at bar. There is no precedent for the extension of Land to a case where, as here, the state references the anticipated testimony of a witness it reasonably expects to recant on the stand, but who ultimately refuses not only to testify, but to be sworn, thus foreclosing the state's ability to use even that witness's out-of-court statement. First, the appellate division mistakenly concluded that Land compelled reversal of defendant Green's conviction, despite the fact that the assistant prosecutor reasonably believed at the outset of trial that Mrs. Smith would testify, and despite the state having taken every possible step to secure her testimony, including securing the material witness order for her presence, securing an order from the trial judge finding that she did not have a valid Fifth Amendment privilege, securing an order after a pretrial hearing pursuant to State versus Gross, allowing the use of Mrs. Smith's out-of-court statement to police in anticipation of potential recantation, and where her attorney had expressly told the court that if granted immunity from prosecution, she would testify. The jury herein was properly instructed that the arguments of counsel are not evidence by both the court and the assistant prosecutor in his opening statement, and the jurors were never told that Mrs. Smith's anticipated testimony was a crucial piece of the state's evidence. To the contrary, a portion of the state's opening statement that was excised from the appellate division's decision told the jury to use corroborating evidence in weighing what Mrs. Smith was expected to say. Significantly, none of the attorneys for the three defendants standing trial for the murder of Eddie Baker lodged an objection to the prosecutor's statements or made a request for a mistrial at the time of the state's opening statement or at any other time. Second, the appellate division erred in concluding that the assistant prosecutor's reference to Mrs. Smith's anticipated testimony also infected defendant Lewis's right to a fair trial, warranting reversal of his conviction. Without any explanation as to how the assistant prosecutor's reference to Mrs. Smith's expected testimony prejudiced Lewis. All references to the co-defendants had been redacted from Mrs. Smith's statement in anticipation of trial. The appellate division's summary conclusion that the taint from the assistant prosecutor's brief reference to Mrs. Smith's anticipated testimony also infected Lewis's trial is without support in the opinion or the record. Third, the appellate division erred in concluding that the curative instruction requested by and partly crafted by Green's counsel was insufficient to address the state's brief reference to Mrs. Smith's expected testimony. In so concluding, the court acknowledged that the state's proofs were strong, but opined that it was unable to conclude beyond a reasonable doubt that the jury's verdicts as to Green and Lewis were not infected by the reference to Mrs. Smith's expected testimony. Despite the fact that trial counsel never asked for a mistrial or any other remedy other than the curative instruction Judge Cook ultimately gave to the jury, the only reference made to Mrs. Smith in the jury's presence since opening statements 23 days earlier, the appellate division concluded that the reference could not have been cured by any curative instruction. The appellate division ignored the fact that the curative instruction was tailored to the specific facts of the case before the court, unlike the instructions given in Land, Walden, and Torres, upon which the court relied. In so concluding, the appellate division acknowledged that the state's proofs were strong, but mischaracterized the nature and of evidence of key witnesses' testimony, including that of eyewitness Ariel Dickens, co-defendant AJ, and DNA evidence placing defendant Lewis and co-defendant Holliday at the victim's residence. Land does not compel the conclusion that every time a witness is reluctant to testify, the state may not reference his or her anticipated testimony at trial, particularly where, as here, it is consistent with the remainder of the state's evidence, where it was not the anticipated testimony of a co-defendant or other involved person, like an eyewitness, and where the state had received assurances from counsel on the record that the witness would testify. Rule 1:7-1A requires the state to give an opening statement to the jury, and the state is required to touch upon all elements of the offense in that opening. The court's reliance upon the broad language that a prosecutor, quote, proceeds at his own peril, from State versus Walden, given the facts of this case, suggests that a prosecutor proceeds at his own peril any time he references an anticipated witness who he believes will contribute to what he expects to prove. Here, the assistant prosecutor provided an outline and a roadmap for the jury of the state's case by providing a general recital of what the state expected in good faith to prove by competent evidence as required by Land. Given the appellate division's erroneous decision that the state's opening statement in this case violated the tenets of State versus Land, this honorable court must reverse the appellate division's decision and reinstate the convictions of Green and Lewis. That concludes the state's opening statement.
Do we know whether or not the prosecutor asked Mrs. Smith before the prosecutor opened whether she would testify and what she would testify to?
All the parties were aware before trial that Mrs. Smith intended to recant her original out-of-court statement made to then-Detective Malin.
We had all of these hearings, where she was basically indicating she was going to take the Fifth. She didn't want to testify against her grandson. My question simply is whether before the prosecutor opened to the jury, at some point before that opening, whether she approached Mrs. Smith and said, "I'm going to call you to the stand. Are you going to testify?"
Well, Mrs. Smith was represented for several weeks before trial began, and I can't say that the assistant prosecutor approached her personally, but
or through an investigator, makes no difference, through an agent.
Well, the understanding after the Fifth Amendment hearing on January 15th, 2015, which was 6 days before openings, was that she would testify. That was her attorney's representation to Judge Cook and to all of the parties in court. Order her to testify, and she will. Cook then on January 20th specifically ordered her to testify.
I may have the date wrong, so please correct me. On January 6th, you get a letter from counsel saying she will invoke the Fifth?
That's right.
Was there an effort to speak with her after that?
Personally, no, but she's represented by Mr. Hillman at that point. Mrs. Smith had already appeared and been sworn at the Gross hearing. She then comes and is sworn at the Fifth Amendment hearing. She comes to court and is sworn, despite making clear that what she alleges she wants to do is correct what she terms lies that she told to Detective Abadia, recant her statement from several years before, but that she understands her obligation to come to court. There's the Fifth Amendment hearing. Her counsel represents, with Mrs. Smith present, that she will testify if ordered to do so.
So, as a former prosecutor, there are many times that a prosecutor does not know or cannot know for certain precisely what a witness will testify to. And many prosecutors will therefore open in a very general way in terms of what the state intends to prove without getting into the particulars of what a witness will say because of the uncertainty. And here, the prosecutor decided to get very, very specific with the most damning piece of information that could have been presented against the defendant, and it wasn't realized.
Well, respectfully, I would disagree that given the state's proofs, it was the most damning piece of evidence. We have the testimony of the co-defendant, AJ, who testified in detail about the planning of the robbery, the execution of the robbery, who went into the victim's home armed
with
the guns.
So the co-defendant, who could have been charged with a felony murder, he pled guilty to manslaughter, was released for 4 years during awaiting the trial. He committed other offenses while he was free, and he had apparently the promise of a very reduced sentence, a 7-year sentence, had referred himself as to the boss, Don Capo. I mean, there was a lot of material here on which AJ, a co-conspirator, was cross-examined, and which would have placed his testimony in some doubt, no?
Well, except that he was cross-examined on all of those things. That was all brought out.
So why are you saying that this is strong? This is not strong, unimpeachable evidence. A co-conspirator who has cut a deal so that he'll be facing a short period of time and also gets immunity from offenses that he's committing while he's out.
Well, that wasn't the state's only evidence. The state also had the testimony of an eyewitness, Ariel Dickens, who identified defendant. It had DNA evidence placing specifically...
Let's talk about Green. Okay, so you mentioned Dickens. She admitted she never had seen him in person, correct? She had
correct.
Seen him on Facebook or something?
She had seen him on two forms of social media.
On the 911 call, she said she didn't know who the robbers were. Am I right about that?
Yes.
During the interview with the police for the first 55 minutes, she never mentioned recognizing Green. Am I correct about that?
Yes.
She provided Green's name only after being permitted to make a phone call and speaking to Zabala. Am I correct about that?
Yes.
And she said she still was not 100% certain about the identification. Am I correct about that?
Yes.
Okay.
That said, the jury was well aware of all these issues. Dickens and AJ were subject to strenuous cross-examination. The jury asked for readbacks of their testimony and clearly carefully considered all of the evidence in front of them.
Last, she said that the person who she thought was Green had bare arms, and Green, in fact, was completely tattooed on his arm, and she had the wrong color shirt, correct?
From the state's perspective, it's not a wrong-colored shirt. He's on a Wawa... On Wawa surveillance footage from approximately 15, 20 minutes before that in a different colored shirt.
Whatever the other evidence in the case may be, you're not suggesting that the comments attributed to the grandmother were not significant in and of themselves, were you?
No, I think they were respectfully significant, but not touted to the jury that way, and that's part of the inquiry that Frazier versus Cupp and other cases talk about. Was this testimony that was not produced... that was given particular focus or emphasis by the state. It was given no more evidence. The state went through all of the evidence it intended to present. And a simple, from the state's perspective, this was not a particularly detailed explanation of what Mrs. Smith was expected to say. The state's obligated, if it's going to provide a roadmap to the jury, and it's obligated to present some evidence of every element of the charges, to put forth what it expects to present and what it expects to prove.
But this was a confession that came out during the opening, was not produced during trial. And even the United States Supreme Court has said, and this isn't a profound statement, confessions have profound impact on the jury, so much so that they may justifiably doubt its ability to put them out of line, even if they're told to do so. And there's a whole line of cases, Bruton, that when it comes to a confession coming even from a co-defendant, we can't even expect limiting instructions to have a proper remedial purpose, because jurists cannot do the sort of mental gymnastics to segregate from their minds the things that they've heard in court.
except that they didn't hear about, they didn't hear testimony about the confession, and they heard a reference 23 days before in a trial that was for reasons not attributable to, you know, not in a negative way to any party in particular, somewhat broken up, and it was never referenced again except at defendant's request for a curative instruction.
Well, the curative, tell me if I'm mistaken about this. The judge came up with the curative instruction, and then the defense attorney said, I think you can improve that instruction. That's what the defense attorney did. And now they're arguing, doesn't make a difference. No curative instruction could cure the type of prejudice that occurred here. That's their argument.
Yes. And from the state's perspective, that's simply not the case. Given the totality of the state's evidence, given case law, given the fact that Torres and other cases even reference when a limiting instruction is appropriately tailored to the facts, when one looks at the relevant cases on this issue, much of the discussion, A, is where a defendant has requested a mistrial and that request has been denied. No one requested a mistrial in this case. I don't want to just repeat myself, but no one objected at the time of the statement. Counsel had actually, for the state, had actually made known many days before trial that he expected to reference Mrs. Smith's statement. And there was actually a fair bit of discussion amongst the parties back at the time of the Gross hearing about the fact that if Mrs. Smith was going to recant, well, and this is from Green's attorney, well, then I expect the state's going to want to use her statement. That really is also, I think, one of the most significant distinctions here. It wasn't...
How could the defense object to the opening? It would require the defense to know whether or not the prosecutor had spoken with Mrs. Smith, and what Mrs. Smith would have told the prosecutor, yeah, I'm going to testify. On what basis would the defendant be able to object to the opening statement made by the prosecutor? I don't understand that.
I would certainly think that the parties would assume that if there had been some sort of out-of-court communication that the state, I mean, that's suggesting a significant amount of bad faith on the part of the state, that it would have known that Mrs. Smith wasn't going to testify and took its chances in referencing her statement. There's no evidence of that in the record.
And she's represented. I mean, it's very significant that she's represented.
She's specifically represented
for... There's an ongoing dialogue between
her and both
lawyers.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. And Mr. Hillman appears on Mrs. Smith's behalf on several occasions in court. And he's the one who really doesn't even understand those were his statements that I read at the beginning of the state's opening statement. Order her to testify. I don't even understand why we're here right now. And I think that is significant in and of itself, because what Judge Cook did, and I think is required to do, as the state noted in its brief pursuant to Burns and Anandi, is leave the door open to see if the witness will in fact testify. The last representation made, not just to the state, but to the court, by refusing to testify, Mrs. Smith wasn't in contempt of the prosecution. She was in contempt of court. And the representation hadn't been made just to the state. It had been made on the record in court by her attorney and not contradicted until after trial had commenced. And at that point, not only when she came to court and was called to testify and given the opportunity to come in, did she not only refuse to testify, but refuse to be sworn. And that's one of the really distinctive factors about this case is Walden and Torres. Walden in particular talks about the state's failure to take any sort of measure to try and ensure the witness's presence at trial. Here, and again, I won't belabor it, it's in the state's brief, but the state, Detective Abadia went down to Georgia, spoke with Mrs. Smith. The appellate division is incorrect when they say that she said she wouldn't come to trial. She said she would come to trial. She said she intended to recant her statement. She then comes and testifies at the Gross hearing. She's sworn and she testifies. She comes to the Fifth Amendment hearing. She's sworn. She refuses to testify, but she's sworn. So at this point, the state 2 months before had already had the Gross hearing and has secured her out-of-court statement with the understanding that if Mrs. Smith so much as shows up at trial, which it expected her to do, and recant, or in a worst-case scenario, refuse to testify, her out-of-court statement was going to come into evidence. Sometime between the Fifth Amendment hearing and when she's called to testify on February 3rd, the state having already opened and the parties having already opened on January 21st, Mrs. Smith suddenly not only is going to recant, she's going to refuse to testify, and she's going to refuse to be sworn.
So let's assume that no one's attributing bad faith to anyone. everyone acted in good faith. You still have a confession that has come in through an opening statement for which there is no support. And therefore, the question is whether or not the jury somehow would be capable of disregarding that testimony. I'm calling it testimony, okay? Because there's an argument that it violates Crawford, right of cross-examination. So the question is, it shouldn't have been there, right? I think we can agree. It shouldn't have been there under the best of all circumstances. The jury has something that it shouldn't have. Was the jury capable of disregarding it so that the defendant was able to receive a fair trial?
I don't think we have any evidence that they weren't. They didn't ask any questions about it. They posed other questions to the court. They asked for readback of the state's witnesses' testimony. Other than in the opening statement and 23 days later in the curative instruction, there was no reference made to Mrs. Smith, including by the jury during its deliberation. Certainly, this is a jury they deliberated on 4 or 5 dates, although they're over the course of approximately 2 weeks.
Would your position assume everything that the prosecutor said came in during a direct examination where there was no cross-examination, so there was Crawford. It came out, let's say the defendant was denied the right to cross-examine the witness, and the very same thing came out. Would your position be the same? Are you following me?
Well, I'm trying to picture a scenario where there was voluntarily no cross-examination?
The same information came out, but it violated the defendant's right of cross-examination. And it went to the jury. Because, in a sense, that's what happened here. Would your position be the same?
I think my position is premised upon the facts of the case, which are very unique. The jury specifically told that that's not evidence, so it's not the same as someone testifying whether they were subject to cross or not during trial. They're told at the beginning of trial. They're reminded at the end of trial. The assistant prosecutor in the case reminded them of that. So they're specifically told it's not evidence.
The purpose of an objection at the time would have been to surface all of this. Had the defendant objected to the opening statement, presumably there would have been a sidebar, and everybody's state of knowledge as to the status of this witness would have come to the surface at that point, and the court would have had the opportunity to rule on what was appropriate to say. Correct? Had there been an objection?
Arguably, yes. Yeah. I don't know that there was any disagreement of the minds. Certainly, the transcripts from up to the date of opening statements indicate that everybody expected at this point the last representation having been made that Mrs. Smith would testify was that she would.
And when someone's represented by counsel, I'm sorry. Chief, when someone's represented by counsel, the two attorneys who are dealing with counsel for a witness entitled to communicate with counsel and accept the representations of counsel on behalf of the client? Not saying it's necessarily going to turn out to be an accurate one, but is there something unreasonable about accepting a lawyer's representation with respect to whether his client was going to show up or not?
No, Justice Patterson, there's not. And I would submit that it wasn't just a representation between colleagues, they weren't really adversaries, but colleagues and attorneys in this case, it was made to the court on the record. That certainly carried significant weight in the state's mind as to what was going to happen.
Clarify what happened after the attorney on the record said, give her the privilege, an inartful way to request an immunity order.
So counsel for Mrs. Smith made that statement at the Fifth Amendment hearing on January 15th, 2015. Subsequently, Judge Cook, the trial judge, the day before opening statements were set on the 20th, issued an opinion ordering Mrs. Smith to testify, finding that she did not have a valid Fifth Amendment privilege, ordering her to testify, and noting that at the time the state had an immunity petition. So all of those safeguards were in place with that representation that Mrs. Smith would testify remaining uncontradicted when the parties opened the next day.
Would you agree that without the immunity order, the judge had no authority to order Mrs. Smith to testify, that she clearly was in jeopardy, because the judge was acting on his own without the immunity order? Mrs. Smith said she was in jeopardy. She said, I gave false testimony to the police officer, and now I'm going to be asked under oath whether or not I lied. Or she was basically saying, I lied then, which would have been a crime. Like, what authority did the court have to order her to testify under those circumstances without the witness actually receiving an immunity order from the Attorney General?
Well, Judge Cook's rationale relied in significant part on the fact that the state represented at the Fifth Amendment hearing. The assistant prosecutor made representations that it would not seek to prosecute Mrs. Smith for any alleged misrepresentations, whether she was concerned that she could be charged for what she was now considering misrepresentations made back when she gave Detective Abadia her original statement, or prosecuted for coming into court and allegedly making misrepresentations at that time. The state made clear they would not pursue prosecution.
Did you secure and serve an immunity order on the witness?
Yes.
But that was, tell me if I'm mistaken, that was the day after the judge actually issued his order. Judge issued his order on January 20th, and on January 21st, you procured a petition for immunity. Am I right about that?
My recollection was that at the time Judge Smith's opinion came out that it had been secured. Nevertheless, it was still before the parties opened.
Can I ask you another question about the opening? There's a passage here that the Aptiv highlights as well, a paragraph on page 47. Ms. Smith is in a difficult position. She's in a position stuck between the love of her grandson and testifying in court. That's a tough position for Mrs. Smith. I understand that it's a difficult position for her. I just hope that when she comes to the witness stand, you too will appreciate the situation that she's in and testifying here in court. Openings are, of course, designed to demonstrate what the evidence will be and not present argument. Did this cross that line?
No, from the state's perspective, it did not. Those comments were made in anticipation or with the understanding that Mrs. Smith, as happens often, would likely come into court and recant. At the time that the state believed Mrs. Smith was, pursuant to her attorney's representations, going to come to court and testify, albeit reluctantly, she was a 62-year-old woman who had just concluded treatment for cancer, was ill, and the state expected to have to treat as, very likely have to treat as a hostile witness in front of this jury. And they were comments meant to serve as context for the fact that in a day or two, the state may be treating her that way. And I think that's why it's significant, looking at those comments, that particular comment that Your Honor points out, it's important to note, as I stated, what the appellate division excluded in its summary of what the assistant prosecutor said. Because he additionally said, you have to consider all of the other evidence in whether or not you believe her statement. You have to look and see if the other evidence corroborates what she said. He didn't make, under any circumstances, and it's not other than for the sake of, you know, brevity of the opinion, it's not really clear to the state why those sentences were left out. But if anything, it disabuses the notion that Mrs. Smith's testimony was held up as sort of the lodestar in this trial. The assistant prosecutor didn't say, Mrs. Smith's testimony, oh, you see how everybody else's testimony is corroborated by hers. He says, you see if her testimony is corroborated by the other evidence in this case. And that's a significant part of the inquiry under Frazier versus Cupp, which I realize is a federal case, and we have cases, although not from this honorable court, addressing this issue. It's absolutely a consideration in Torres and in Walden and in Cupp as to whether the state touted this. And I'm not suggesting or trying to play any sort of semantics game with the court. It was an important part of the state's case, but it wasn't touted to the jury as something incredibly significant. It wasn't touted to the jury as anything in particular, anything more weighty than the DNA evidence, the expected testimony of the eyewitness, testimony of the juvenile.
There was no DNA evidence against Green, was there?
There was. There was the testimony of AJ. There was...
I said DNA.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You said DNA
I'm
testimony.
Sorry. No, not as to Carrie Green specifically, but there's Wawa surveillance footage showing the parties together. There's the testimony of AJ. There's the testimony of Errol Dickens placing him in the residence.
Would you agree that the testimony of a grandmother carries with it greater weight than the testimony of a cooperating witness who is looking for a favor from the state?
I think our case law would suggest the contrary. Our case law talks about, in great detail, the specific potential damage occasioned by the testimony of co-defendants and other people involved. They use the term the criminal milieu.
Is there any reason for a juror listening to this opening to look askance at what the grandmother was about to testify to, according to that opening?
Based on the state's comments? Not necessarily, but I don't think the state's ever in the position of...
You're looking at this as a single piece of evidence and comparing it to others. People look askance because common sense tells us to at a cooperator who is facing a jail sentence. Do they look at grandmothers in the same way?
I think it's impossible for me to speculate about what kind of witness Mrs. Smith would have been. Certainly she was going to be in an interesting position given that she was going to be recanting her out-of-court statement, but I mean, there's all types of grandmothers. I don't say that to be smart. I don't want to generalize about a specific relationship carrying more weight than another relationship other than the fact that certainly even with the arguably inherent credibility problems which can be addressed on cross-examination, are the cases that go to this issue specifically talk about the particular damage of when a jury is told that a co-defendant who planned in and participated a crime with a defendant is the jury's told to expect that and it's not produced.
After Mrs. Smith's attorney represented that she would testify if given immunity, and after the petition and the immunity order, and after she then refused and went to jail instead, was there any discussion by anybody on behalf of anybody about a mistrial?
No one.
And nobody ever brought it up?
Nobody brought it up.
By the time the case was over and all the evidence was in, the opening statement had been made however many days before, 27 days, did anybody discuss, bring up, consider the impact of the opening statement or the possibility of a mistrial?
I don't know whether... respectfully, I don't know whether defense counsel considered it. Certainly,
I'm not talking about what was in their head.
Right.
Is there anything in the record
No.
that anybody said,
no,
we should have a mistrial, this is very prejudicial, this
No.
is a problem? So
Nothing.
After 23 days of trial, after the opening statement, nobody ever brought up, asked for, or considered, as far as you know, a mistrial?
No.
However, somebody did bring up a charge to the jury.
That's right.
And was that defense counsel or was that the court?
That was defense counsel for Mr. Green.
Okay. And at that point, there was a cautionary instruction drafted, still no request for mistrial, right?
Correct.
And finally approved, reviewed, edited by defense counsel, not objected to by the prosecutor, and read to the jury, correct?
That's right.
After the trial was concluded, was there a request for JNOV, but any discussion of mistrial?
No, there was, after conviction, a motion for a new trial
right.
made on a number of grounds, but not, like, after the jury's verdict, an immediate motion, no.
Okay.
So
I trust your contention is that that should have some bearing on the remedy that we fashion here.
It does, and the state argued in its brief that if not invited error, that this was to a large extent acquiesced to error. Counsel raised the issue, asked for a curative instruction. Judge Cook initially wrote a curative instruction. Counsel felt that the language in it was too deferential to the state. Said to the judge, I think it should be phrased more this way. Judge Cook phrased it the way counsel for Mr. Green asked him to phrase it, and he read that instruction to the jury. And it is everything that the instructions in Walden and Land and the other relevant cases where a curative instruction was even given, because in some cases it was not, were not, which were just the general language on, the opening. The comments of counsel are not evidence. This was specifically tailored to Mrs. Smith and disregarding any reference to her.
I was just going to ask you to please address your position on the prejudicial effect of this testimony to the extent the court may view it as such with respect to the conviction of Mr. Lewis.
From the state's perspective, the extension of the court's rationale and of course the state's position is that it's firmly incorrect as to Mr. Green, but is even far more attenuated and really without explanation by the appellate division as to Mr. Lewis, mm-hmm. particularly given, and I understand that all the defendants were before the court under a felony murder theory. That said, the jury was never told, of course, pursuant to Bruton, that Mrs. Smith was going to say anything about any of the co-defendants. And in fact, it was at that gross hearing and after that gross hearing when the parties said, well, you know, we anticipate you may need to use her statement if she's going to recant, that they undertook the Bruton redaction of Mrs. Smith's statement, that it was excised of any reference to anybody else. It's also important to note that the prosecutor's comments are brief, but it's important to note that Mrs. Smith never gave a statement that defendant and the co-defendants went to her house the night of the murder. The assistant prosecutor, AJ, says at trial that they went to her house and Carrie Green went in with a backpack. Mrs. Smith doesn't say that. In Mrs. Smith's tape statement to Detective Abadia and Detective Angelasio, the assistant prosecutor was correct about that at some point after the events of July 16th. So Mrs. Smith was never going to be able to corroborate AJ's testimony that they went to her house that night. And Detective Abadia asks her quite a bit about that. And I know I'm getting a little off track, but as to Lewis, I think it's important to note factually
there's forensic evidence against Lewis as well.
There's significant forensic evidence against Lewis. The appellate division talks about the fact that a hat that was left behind at the scene had Mr. Lewis's DNA on it. It also had the victim's DNA on it. And although the jury was hung as to Mr. Holliday, who's also on the surveillance footage with the other two, and Ms. AJ testifies was with them the entire evening, ran right out of his shoe when they fled the scene. So there is significant forensic evidence. There was never, the appellate division...
They acquitted Holliday.
The jury was hung as to Holliday, and he subsequently was tried alone and was acquitted.
Okay. And one of the differences between Green and Holliday is that Holliday was not implicated in the opening statement through Mrs. Smith's reported statement, correct?
Well, I think one of the significant differences as to Holliday was he really wasn't in the residence. He briefly went inside the doorway and came back out. And I think, if anything, that shows how carefully the jury considered all of the evidence before them, because they made a distinction between... Mrs. Smith didn't reference Mr. Lewis either, but the jury was able to make the distinction between the two people that they heard testimony entered that house armed with handguns, and Mr. Holliday, who essentially popped into the doorway and came back out and served as the lookout person.
Did Smith discuss Lewis or just Green?
Only Green.
Only Green.
Well, in her statement, she talked about what her grandson had told her, but what the jury heard was only, because of, you know, the Bruton redactions, that Mrs. Smith, that Carrie Green had told his grandmother he had been engaged with the victim in a struggle over this handgun.
You had very powerful forensic evidence against Lewis.
Yes, which is what makes that... the vacation of his conviction from the state's perspective even more of an attenuation than that of Green.
Is there anything else you'd like to add at this point?
If your honors have no other questions for the state, I do not.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Nikova.
Good afternoon, your honors. May it please the court. Aside for all the issues that the state addressed, the Attorney General has a particular concern with the fact that defendants now challenge the relief that they specifically requested during the trial. Defendants wanted a curative instruction. Actually, Mr. Green wanted a curative instruction, and Defendant Lewis did not actually entirely was silent on the issue. So they wanted a curative instruction during the trial, and now that the original strategy did not work out, they say that the issue was so grave that mistrial should have granted. Nobody requested a mistrial. At no point mistrial was brought up, and it's unclear how would the whole issue of mistrial would have come about. Defendants should not be encouraged to make such strategic decisions and take a certain course of action and then turn around and appeal and take a different course of action after they originally led the court into error.
I'm trying to understand, how is requesting that the judge try to cure something prejudicial in error? The the defense attorney and the court may do their very, very best to put a Band-Aid on something that perhaps you is too small for the wound. But why is it an error to try to cure the prejudice? That's what I'm trying to understand.
It is not an error to try to cure the prejudice, but the defendant's actions led the court into acting a certain way. The court issued a specially crafted instruction instead of
If they believed it was so damaging that it couldn't be cured, thus requesting a mistrial, then they should have
requested a mistrial
instead of a cure instruction. The fact that they asked for leads you to believe that they didn't think it was so significant until their strategy went awry.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Even if there had been no request for a curative instruction, didn't by defense counsel, wouldn't the court have a singular obligation to give a curative instruction? You had an opening statement, the presentation of damning evidence that was not produced at trial. The court would have had to give a curative instruction if nothing was said. Do you disagree with that?
Well, the court does have an obligation, and the court generally gives the instruction that opening statements and closing statements are not to be considered evidence, and only what was presented as testimony or came in as evidence during trial is to be considered. But in this case, the defense attorney wanted a specifically tailored instruction.
And got it.
And they got it, yes. And this was not the defense attorney who was shy to object. There was plenty of objections throughout the trial. So
But if it wasn't good enough, okay, so the effort was made and the curative instruction was not able to dissipate or remove the prejudice and the defendant was denied a fair trial, is it not the obligation of an appellate court to set it right?
Well, it is to do so when the defense attorneys actually strategically decided to take a certain course of action is to encourage certain gamesmanship where the defendants can act certain way during trial and take their chances. Maybe they liked the jury they had. Maybe we weren't there. The defense attorneys were there. And maybe they thought they had the jury.
And the court was there, and the court could have assessed, if a motion for a mistrial had been made, the court could have assessed with all of the evidence that the court had been watching unfold, whether or not this was so prejudicial that it could not be cured by a curative instruction. Had a mistrial been requested?
Has a mistrial been requested? Yes, but it wasn't. And the only conclusion that can be drawn is that the defense attorneys did not see that it was so prejudicial, it was such gravely prejudiced to their clients that it had to be a mistrial. They thought it could be cured. They thought the jury could follow the instruction.
Let's say they did think that. And let's say they were mistaken. Let's say they should have actually filed this motion for a mistrial. That would have been the better course. If the defendant was denied a fair trial, if the jury was unable to keep from its mind that opening statement, does it make a difference? The defendant had a right to a trial based upon properly presented evidence.
Well,
should the failure to move for a mistrial make a difference?
Well, if the defendant at the time of the trial did not think that it was so prejudicial, and then after he lost and he was convicted, he decided that it's now prejudicial, that it is something maybe should be taken up on a PCR against his defense counsel, but it's not something for the appellate court to assess.
Anything else you'd like to
say? Yes, please. I just would like to add to the state's argument that reversing conviction in relationship to Lewis was particularly erroneous since, first of all, the grandma's supposed testimony never even mentioned Lewis to begin with, and there was a lot of evidence against Lewis. There was his DNA at the house, and he left his hat that he was seen wearing on Wawa video about 20 minutes before the crime took place, and the hat also had the DNA of the victim on it. So to reverse Lewis's conviction was particularly erroneous on the appellate division's behalf, and the attorney general would ask that the state reverses the erroneous decision ruling and reinstate defendant's convictions, both of them.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Markarian.
May it please the court. prosecutor in this case acknowledged that Carrie Greene's alleged confession to his grandmother, Ethel Smith, was the single most important piece of evidence that the state had of his guilt. As the state argued before the trial court, once the jury hears it, there can only be one conclusion, and that's felony murder. The jury was not presented with any evidence of Mr. Greene's alleged confession during his trial, but the jury still heard about the confession because the prosecutor provided a detailed description of the confession in his opening statement. This opening told a memorable and dramatic story that placed before the jury powerful information that was never entered into evidence.
I'm sorry, did you say that the state told the court that the most important piece of evidence was the confession?
Yes, Your Honor, the state did tell it.
Can you give us a citation to that?
Yes, it's 19T 27-2-7. It was not, the state did not tell the jury that. The state told the trial court that when it was arguing that there was forfeiture by wrongdoing by Mr. Greene. It said this is the single most important piece of evidence we have. So this was a description of critical and compelling evidence by the state's own account of Mr. Greene's guilt that was never admitted at trial, and this created an intolerable risk that the jury may have relied on facts outside of the evidence in reaching its verdict, depriving Mr. Greene of his right to a fair trial and to confront the witnesses against him. This court should affirm the appellate division's decision, reversing Mr. Greene's convictions.
So that day, if I've got the right transcript, was the day that Grandma was held in contempt.
Yes,
right?
Your Honor.
Why didn't you move for a mistrial then?
As the state says in its brief, it was still unclear whether she would continue to refuse to testify for the duration of trial. So it was not yet clear. It was an ongoing situation, and Mr. Greene's counsel was not representing Ms. Smith.
Was it clear at the end of the trial that she wasn't going to testify?
It was clear, Your Honor.
There was no mistrial motion then either, right?
Yes, Your Honor. A mistrial should have been moved for, but we are so far afield from what this court has held as invited error. Under State v. Jenkins, to be invited error, the court would have to rely on an express representation by defense counsel in reaching its decision. In State v. Jenkins, we know that it was a strategic move by defense counsel to not request a lesser included instruction, but the court knew that it still had an independent obligation to decide whether the lesser included instruction needed to be given. And so even though defense counsel...
What does that have to do with the request for a mistrial?
I'm sorry?
What does that do with the request for a mistrial, the fact that defense counsel felt they had been very successful in their cross-examination of the co-defendant AJ and other evidence that they brought out and simply said, this is our best shot, we're not taking that chance, we're going to see what the jury does, and by the way, it's a darn good argument after that.
We don't know why defense counsel didn't ask for a mistrial in the heat of trial.
But we know they didn't.
We know they didn't ask
at any time, not even after trial.
They moved for a new trial after trial.
No. After the verdict came.
Yeah.
But
any time at all before that, move for a mistrial, make the calculation that we're making in hindsight, and say this is so damaging, 23 days ago, what he said in that opening, not that this is the most important piece of evidence, just what he said in the opening, that we better get a new trial because this is going down. Any indication that was the thought process?
Well, I think that was why defense counsel tried to craft a curative, and ultimately defense counsel tried
that
to do their best.
That completely ducks the question. Any indication as to why at that point things are so god-awful, this evidence is so damaging, very, very good defense counsel, by the way, Camden County person, very, very good lawyer, made a calculation that I'm not going to ask.
He's unbiased.
Totally unbiased.
We don't know why she made that calculation. She didn't put into the record, you know, I don't need a mistrial. The court didn't say.
It didn't even occur to her, apparently. She didn't raise it at all.
Your Honor, we don't know, but this is plain error. This is so far afield from an invited error, and that's why the question is, was it clearly capable of causing an unjust result?
You concede that that counsel should have moved for a mistrial.
Absolutely. Absolutely, she should have. This was so damaging. There was no coming back from this. And as Your Honor highlighted, there were real reasons to doubt the credibility of the two central state's witnesses against Mr. Greene. And the real risk was that the jury may have resolved these lingering doubts by relying on the confession that was described to them. And the state even supplied a reason, why the jury may not hear from Mrs. Smith, and gave the jury that indication, you know, she's in a really tough position. She's stuck between the love of her grandson and testifying in court. So in the absence of her testifying, there's a real risk that the jury had that in the back of their mind from this memorable opening statement. there's a real risk they had that in the back of their mind the whole trial. When they were hearing AJ's testimony, when they were hearing Miss Dickens' testimony, they don't know that grandma's in contempt. They don't know that they're never going to hear from her. They could be thinking in the back of their mind, this is all going to be corroborated by confession that came from the defendant himself and was made to his grandmother. And he had no indication or no motivation to lie to his own grandmother. And
so if you follow that, good, you.
That portion of the opening, do you believe that it was evidence or argument?
I believe it placed before the jury evidence that was not admitted at trial. I don't believe it was evidence, but I believe it was the equivalent, it may have been the equivalent of evidence in the mind of jurors, so that's why I do believe it violated.
You did not object to what arguably was argument. Why not?
Well, I wasn't defense counsel at trial.
That's the best reason of all.
I would love to receive the compliments that defense counsel at trial has received, but...
to the extent that was problematic.
To the extent...
Could have drawn an objection after the opening statement.
Again, at that time, it was not known that Ms. Smith would not refuse to testify, and so there was no basis. Defense counsel had not been able to participate in...
I'm talking about the language that you picked up on earlier, which I read... To your colleague about being stuck between the love of a grandson and testifying, that rhetorical flourish, which was not a summary of what the evidence the jury was about to hear would be.
Yeah, I don't know why defense counsel at trial did not object to that, and perhaps she should have. I know that often in opening there is practice of not raising a lot of objections. And
didn't she may not have objected at the time of the opening, but when she was having her colloquy with the court over the curative instruction, she did highlight the impact of that argument, and I think she was more or less treating it as argument because the way it was phrased, she was recognizing that it gave the state the benefit of the doubt. Don't hold it against the state if she does not testify. So it wasn't so much just the facts to which she would be testifying, but also if she doesn't testify, that still might corroborate the state's position here.
Exactly, Your Honor. And it was the most favorable possible version of her anticipated testimony.
She may not have gone about it in the most comprehensive way in seeking the curative instruction, but she was clearly getting to the point that the chief is making with you, isn't she?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
That's at the charge conference?
It's at the charge conference on February 11th.
22 days after the opening statement?
Well,
and
again,
after
Your
all
Honor,
the evidence was in?
Again, Your Honor, it was not clear until the close of trial that Ms. Smith wouldn't be testifying, and the remark was particularly damaging because she did not testify. Yes, it was argument and should not have been made whether she testified or not. But the real damage was that in the absence of her testimony, the jurors were provided with a reason that was attributable to the defense and not to the prosecution.
And now, I take it back for a minute to what you said a little earlier. You said that the jury might have been thinking at the opening statement, whether there's evidence is going to be corroborated, it's very important, we're going to hear it. Doesn't it follow then that when they didn't, it wasn't corroborated, they would say, boy, that's not evidence at all. If that's what they were thinking, doesn't it follow then that when it didn't come, as a matter of fact, it would have made it even weaker? Because now something they were expecting to follow up and corroborate that never came?
No, Your Honor, and for two reasons. The prosecutor is a figure of authority in the minds of jurors, and the jurors know that the prosecutor has access to evidence that will not ultimately make it into the trial. And so the jurors know that the prosecutor's reference might be to something that's being kept from them for
that
reasons.
That is completely contrary to our law. Every notion of instructions to juries, you're basically throwing the whole, a lot of jurisprudence out the window. When you make a statement like that, that's just not how we work. That's not how prosecutors work. Not how public defenders work. It's not how juries work. It's not how judges work.
I'm not sure what you're alluding to in terms of the case law, but
the fact that jurors are deciding cases based on facts that are not before them and never been presented, and they're just guessing at it and thinking the prosecutor may know something more than he's telling us. We're going to assume what that is and believe it.
I think
it just doesn't work that way.
Jurisprudence has acknowledged there are risks, that there are cases where curatives cannot be followed.
We don't have to look at jurisprudence here. The prosecutor gave in an opening statement her understanding of what a witness was going to say. Okay, we don't have to divine that. It's on a piece of paper that was delivered to the jury, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. And one of the most damaging things here is the prosecutor also said there was a recorded statement that confirmed her anticipated testimony. So even when she didn't testify, it wasn't the prosecutor said she would testify this way, and she never testified. It was the prosecutor said that she had made a recorded statement to police officers that presumably the prosecutor had reviewed in preparing the case that existed whether or not Ms. Smith testified.
Well, so, what is your understanding on behalf of your client as to the state of the knowledge of counsel for your client on the day of opening with respect to Mrs. Smith is going to show up, take the fifth, recant, not show up?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. And the ruling,
I know you weren't there, but what's your position with respect to what was known?
My understanding is the ruling was made. There was the 104 hearing at which the court considered whether Ms. Smith could plead the fifth. That was a few weeks before trial. The ruling that she could not plead the fifth was made by the court the day before trial in a written order. And so I don't know if there were communications after that order, but on the first day of trial, I'm not sure whether there had been communications between the state and Ms. Smith about whether they understood she would testify. But I know that the state speaks a lot about the representation that was made at the 104 hearing by Ms. Smith's counsel, but from my perspective, I don't see why that representation should have anything to do with Mr. Green's right to a fair trial. The good faith or the bad faith of the prosecutor in making a representation is not relevant to the ultimate question of, is there a real risk that the jury relied on information that was never entered into evidence in reaching its verdict?
But it is relevant, isn't it? Isn't the state of the knowledge, not so much of defense counsel in that case, but of the prosecutor with respect, with the state of play, to use a general term, with respect to whether she is going to show up, is relevant to our consideration of this issue, isn't it?
Your Honor, it may play a role in your consideration. I would submit that in this case there were many indications that she may seek to avoid testifying. But I would
but
also
the last
submit
word,
that
as far as we can tell, and it's a little confusing, I will, you know, I think you probably agree, the last word was from her lawyer saying, I need one thing for this client, I need a grant of immunity. He used a sort of odd term for it, but that's what he meant. And the grant of immunity had materialized at that point.
It's unclear to me from reading the record whether the way the state references it is on the first day of trial after the court has already ruled that she can plead the fifth. The prosecutor says, in the alternative, we would have given her immunity. So I don't know whether there were communications between the prosecutor and her counsel in which, you know, that offer of immunity was actually actualized, or if that was just something that the prosecutor was placing on the record. But regardless, what concerns me is that at the end of the day, defendant was found not to have committed any wrongdoing in preventing her from testifying. So even if we accept the prosecutors, acted in good faith and did everything that the prosecutor could before the beginning of trial to ensure that she testified, Mr. Green is very prejudiced by her testimony being described in detail in the prosecutor's opening statement and not having the opportunity to actually have the jury see her, hear about her recantation, which they never learn about, and also learn about her explanation for why she made this
But don't we look to the reasonableness of what the prosecutor said?
I really don't think that the reasonableness should play a role in looking at whether there's a risk that the jury may have based its verdict on information outside the record. It's not about whether the prosecutor exercised good judgment or bad judgment. It's about whether defendant had a fair trial and whether there was information that was brought in from outside the record that was presented to the jury that may have influenced the verdict. So I don't think it makes, I don't think it should make a difference. Even if Ms. Smith had unequivocally said, I will testify, and there had been a conversation between her and the prosecutor, and then she ultimately didn't, and the prosecutor made this statement in opening, that still is just as damaging to Mr. Green and just as prevalent in the minds of jurors, whether the prosecutor acted in good faith or bad faith.
Did I mishear you? Did you say that the jury was told there was a tape recording
of
Ms. Smith's statement?
Yes, Your Honor.
I don't recall that. I don't have it in my notes. I didn't. In his opening statement, he said there was a recording in which the defendant confesses.
not in which defendant confesses, but in which Ms. Smith makes a recorded statement describing the confession that the defendant had made to her.
Where is that? I'm sorry.
So that's in the transcript from January 13th. I'm not sure
page 7 of the bench memo.
It's page 46.
I'm looking at it.
Line 23.
It's page 7
I
of the bench
memo. I submit that what she said during this taped statement to Detective Abadia. Can I ask you a question about the mistrial? Assume extremely competent counsel and complete good faith. Can a defense attorney say, "Now that was pretty bad what I just saw. I certainly can get a curative instruction. I also believe I would be entitled to a mistrial or a new trial. I'm going to ask for the curative instruction now, see if I get an acquittal, and if I don't, I'll seek the greater remedy later." Is that permissible as you understand the law?
I think we're making a lot of assumptions about what the strategic reason was.
Run with my assumptions, and if you could please answer the question.
I think that the Court on Appeal would still have to answer the question of whether the error was clearly capable of producing an unjust result under the plain error standard, unless defense counsel had made a representation to the court. A mistrial is not necessary, and the court relied on that representation. Then we move into the plain error, or the invited error, the world of invited error. But if we assume that it was a strategic calculation, then that was never made explicit, then I still think we're in plain error, and we still have to ask, was the error clearly capable of producing an unjust result?
What you're saying is, regardless of the strategic calculations, ultimately it's up to the court to ensure that defendant receives a fair trial, and correct? And
exactly,
and
you
gave those examples about the lesser included, where this court specifically said no matter what jockeying counsel may be doing, ultimately the court has to ensure that the jury is properly charged.
Exactly, Your Honor.
You said that you didn't think it was part of the standard as to what state of knowledge is not part of the standard. The only thing that matters is prejudice. But Torres, and later quoted by this court in Wakefield, says a prosecutor's opening statement should provide an outline, a roadmap of the state's case. It should be limited to a general recital of what the state expects in good faith to prove by competent evidence. So doesn't that take us to, is it error at all, as opposed to, you know, you've talked at length about the plain error, invited error, but is it error at all is it plain error for that statement to have been made? We need to go to what was knowable by the state, what was in good faith expected by the state.
I think that language was in the context of prosecutorial misconduct specifically, and it was an instruction to prosecutors how to avoid committing
misconduct.
Understood,
but that's the standard. That's what the standard is for what the state can do and in an opening statement. The same would apply to a defense opening statement.
Yes, Your Honor. It's an instruction for best practices. But even a prosecutor who engages in best practices in some rare cases, and I would submit that this is one, may summarize in detail evidence that is so damning that even if the prosecutor acted in good faith, they have violated the defendant's right to a fair trial.
Even if the circumstances were such that the state expected in good would expect in good faith, well, none of us can get into that lawyer's head, but the state expects in good faith to prove by competent evidence, we don't look to what was known to the state, what was known at that moment of the opening?
If this were just a prosecutorial misconduct claim, then perhaps that would be relevant, but if we're talking about the right to confrontation and the right to ensure that the verdict was based on the evidence presented to the jury, I think for those questions, it's just not relevant what was known by the prosecutor. The relevant question is, what was the jury, what was placed before the jury, and did defense counsel have an opportunity to explore it through cross-examination? And I don't see how the prosecutor's knowledge affects that inquiry.
So if that's so, there's really no risk to, or very little risk for a defense counsel to just not move for a mistrial at that time and see how it goes, because what you're saying is if it turns out to be viewed later as prejudicial, it doesn't matter really what the circumstances were at the time of the opening. That's a good position for defense counsel to be in.
I think this is a really rare class of cases, and you can see that Walden, which was decided by the appellate division in 2004, also said that the good faith is not relevant of the prosecutor.
Wasn't there a motion for a mistrial in Walden?
Your Honor, I don't recall. I believe there may have been, but in terms of the good faith question, you know, this is a really rare class of cases where the information is so damaging, and here you have the state's own characterization. A confession is unlike any other evidence, and there's no reason to believe an actor without learning more detail about the confession would lie about their own criminal conduct, and especially to a close loved one.
There was a motion for mistrial.
There may be cases, and there may be many cases where the failure to raise a mistrial will make a difference, where the nature of the prejudice may be closer. Your position, as I hear it, is that the nature of the prejudice was so overwhelming here that the failure to make a mistrial should not make a difference.
Yes, Your Honor. In this case, it was clearly capable of causing an unjust result. In other cases, when we're talking about, you know, the state may think there will be four eyewitnesses and may say, you know, without getting into detail about the eyewitnesses and their each of their position in opening, you're going to hear from four eyewitnesses. And then if there's only three eyewitnesses that ultimately testify, we can be pretty confident the jury did not rest its verdict on that fourth eyewitness it never heard from, because it wasn't given any special reason. There was no, the nature of that evidence was duplicative. There was not a lot of detail about what that eyewitness's testimony would show. And the weight of the other evidence that actually was introduced at trial was strong. Here, the nature of the evidence was unique. It was uniquely damaging. It was a confession by the defendant himself. The detail that was provided was uniquely damaging because the confession, the jury learned, was made to his own grandmother, and it also was recorded in a tape statement to police officers. It was all given, and the jury was also supplied with a reason why they might not hear that testimony by the prosecutor. And finally, the balance of the evidence that actually was introduced was weak. There were two witnesses who both had serious credibility and reliability issues. Miss Dickens, her identification, I can't think of an additional fact I would add to make it less persuasive or reliable. She said that she identified one of two masked men who she saw for 15 to 30 seconds holding weapons before she fled as Mr. Green, who she'd never met before and had only seen on social media. And she only made that identification after a lengthy period of interrogation where she was had never offered his name. And then she was given a break to make a phone call and to speak with another one of the other women who was there. And Mr. AJ as well, I also would submit, was not a very reliable witness, and the jury was given ample reason to question his credibility because of the substantial benefits he received. So there's a real risk that the lingering doubts about the credibility of those two witnesses may have been resolved by the jurors in reference to this confession, which they learned existed in a tape-recorded form and which was ultimately not submitted into evidence. So I would ask this court to affirm the appellate division's decision reversing Mr. Green's convictions.
Thank you. Mr. Confucione.
I don't want to go over the same ground that the court has already heard. So I'd be happy to field questions. I'm sure the court might have a few questions.
Then let's zone in on your client, as to whom there is stronger evidence because of the forensic evidence, and whom the grandmother did not implicate in the remarks made in opening statement that summarized.
Mm-hmm.
How are you entitled to have the conviction reversed under those circumstances?
Well, it's certainly a closer case, but I think even if you apply a plain error standard, you know, it isn't the fact that the grandmother didn't directly implicate my client, because I think what's significant is the prosecution's case against both my client and Mr. Green, where they acted the same. In other words, there wasn't really even any specificity as to who did what. They were both charged with the robbery and the felony murder at the scene, and their actions were alleged to have been the same in that respect. They were essentially co-participants. So if the jury said, well, the one guy confessed to his grandmother, then my guy's obviously going to be implicated in the statement.
Holliday was acquitted. Hung jury and acquitted.
Right.
So it's clear that the jury was capable of making distinctions between the defendants. No?
Well, I mean, look, the only thing that really makes the case more powerful against my client was the hat.
The hat that had his DNA and the victim's right. DNA. That's pretty powerful evidence.
Well, I guess what I would say is this, Your Honor. The court could analyze the case and then look at whether or not the trial was fair and say, even if there was an unfairness to it, we're still going to affirm the conviction of my client because of the fact that there was a hat with DNA evidence on it.
There's also a jury charge mm-hmm. in which the court instructs the jury, consider each individually. Are we overlooking that?
I don't think we're overlooking it, but I don't really think that has that much power to it because both defendants were found equally guilty in the case, at least the two that are on appeal here. I mean, the only thing you can really hang it on is the hat. And I don't, even though the court could make that conclusion, I don't think that it should, given the power of this problem. I mean, my view of the overall case would be, you know, there's really nothing. I think this is actually worse than the Land case because, I mean, there's just nothing to me more powerful than the prosecutor getting up and saying the defendant, one of the two defendants, confessed to his grandma. I mean, that's a pretty powerful piece of evidence.
How about DNA with the victim on the same hat?
I mean, the DNA you can at least combat in terms of you could have brought in a scientific expert to combat it. You could have said, well, the guy who testified against this, the alleged co-perpetrator, might have been wearing the hat as well or planted it there. You could have arguments against
it. And there were arguments made about the DNA.
Yeah, but in other words, in terms of the power of the actual thing, I would look at it in this way. There's a grand difference, I know the court knows this, between a civil case and a criminal case. This isn't a civil case, and I understand the defense lawyers didn't object. But first of all, and the lawyers, I'm sure, all did a good job, even the prosecutor. I'm sure they all acted in good faith. But the fact is, the record shows the prosecutor who got up and made the opening statement knew there was some risk that this woman was not going to testify. He himself said on the record, I'm afraid she's going to take the Fifth Amendment. After she gave her original statement, she started to retract from it. They knew there was a risk. They went out and gave this detailed opening statement, which they didn't have to do. So they started the chain of events. The defense lawyers obviously should ask for a mistrial, at least at the close of the case in chief, when the grandmother didn't appear. But it's not the kind of a case where we can say, well, we looked at the case and there was a strategic reason to request a mistrial. There's no strategic reason. How did it help the two defendants at the trial for the prosecutor to tell them the grandmother's going to come up and tell us that the one guy confessed to her that he killed the guy?
If you were the only voice asking for a mistrial on the on the day that grandma was sent to jail, would you have had a basis? Would you have had a strong case representing your client?
Say that again, Your Honor. I didn't quite understand what you're asking.
Could you have made the argument at trial that you're advancing now with persuasive force, and I'm not doubting your advocacy. You're a different defendant.
The proofs
are different against you. Whatever grandma said wasn't about you.
You know, you can always make that conclusion, but again, because it's a joint trial and the prosecution, it's not like the prosecution said, Mr. Green did this part of the event and Mr. Lewis did something else. They really couldn't separate what they did. They were both lumped in as the two that went into the place and the guy was killed. So to me, that's really, you know, the only distinction is one had a DNA evidence hat. It makes my case harder on a harmful error, but if I was the defense lawyer and asked for a mistrial, I would submit that under New Jersey law it should have been granted because, you know, the prosecutor put forth this powerful evidence from a witness who never appeared.
But not about your client at all. Yeah. Nothing was said about your client at all.
But he alleged, go ahead, Judge.
I'll point it to the other person.
But, Judge, they're the two alleged co-perpetrators on a felony murder case.
But
it's a distinction without a difference.
There's no evidence provided against your client. By that reason, and if you're co-perpetrators, they both should be found guilty, and we know from this case one at least wasn't. So I don't understand your theory. There was no evidence presented as to your client here that by the grandmother, by the prosecutor in the opening statement, that tied your client to the crime.
There's no way a jury here in this trial and hearing that, if that grandmother had gotten up and testified, are you saying that the grandmother's testimony would have had no impact on the co-defendant, my guy?
Well, tell me what the evidence would have been against your guy from the grandmother testifying, based on the statement.
That the guy he's alleged to have acted jointly with confessed to the murder. That's devastating evidence. I frankly don't think it really matters from a prejudice standpoint. There's no real meaningful distinction between the fact that it was Green's grandmother or my guy's grandmother. It would have been the same damaging thing to put before the jury. And I think the main thing comes down to a criminal case is not a civil case. If this was a civil case, I'd have no argument. I agree with your honors that the guy should have objected. There's no reason not to have asked for a mistrial, none. There's no strategic advancement for my client by the trial lawyer not asking for a mistrial. I assume they were good lawyers, but it didn't cause a fair trial. And appellate courts, especially in our state, even appellate attorneys, you know, it's a process. You look at the case and you say, was this a trial that was based on a fair process? Because that's really all you can do. You look at the process. And when the prosecutor gets up and says, well, the grandmother said that her grandson confessed to her, it's prejudicial.
So what do you say to this argument?
Yeah.
We're 10 days in, 4 days jury selection, 6 days of evidence have been presented. Pretty good cross. I think I've got a good chance here.
Yeah.
I'm going to strategically decide not to seek a mistrial because I think I have a winner. No strategic reason not to ask for a mistrial?
No strategic reason from a fairness process because I'll give you another example. Let's say that the prosecutor and the defense attorneys got together and they were two of the best ones in the state and they said, well, we're not going to call witnesses, we're going to roll dice. If the guy goes down and he's guilty, he's guilty. I mean, there are certain decisions that can't be justified from a fairness perspective. And I do think the defense lawyer, and I don't know the defense lawyer, I wasn't in the case. I do think he probably said, I'm going to take my chances, maybe I'll get an acquittal. But that doesn't translate for a fair trial for the defendant. And I do think the appellate courts have an oversight duty. And frankly, even the judge does. I don't know why the trial judge didn't go, how am I going to let this go to a jury verdict when the woman that you highlighted in your opening never testified?
I think your argument is, and it's not necessarily a palatable one, is I get to both ask for the charge and seek a new trial later.
Not necessarily. And here's why. My colleague there made a tremendous argument, but I do think the prosecutors, to your question, Your Honor, I think the prosecutor's knowledge, I know they talk about it in terms of good or bad faith. I don't think there was any bad faith by the prosecutor in terms of the prosecutor didn't go, we know she's not going to testify. Let's just try to prejudice the trial.
That's an important comment, but I don't think it answered the chief's question. Chief was asking us
about whether or not they can have both.
About the strategy of the lawyers.
I don't think they can have both because I think it affects the standard of review. I think if the prosecutor had done the same thing and the defense lawyer had objected, the burden would be very heavy on the prosecution to sustain this verdict and show that it was a fair trial and wasn't impacted by the mistake. I think the difference, Your Honor, is when you sit there silently and don't ask for a mistrial, the burden becomes very heavy on the defendant on the appeal to demonstrate kind of a rigorous plain error review, that this really was clearly capable of producing an unjust result. But on that score, I think that's where the court should say he needs a new trial in the case because of the nature of what the grandmother was. If the prosecutor had gotten up and done the same thing, except the witness, instead of a confession to a grandmother, it was some other witness that maybe added to a piece of the case, my argument wouldn't be anywhere near
as
good.
You're saying that we know that defense counsel engaged in the type of strategic maneuvering that the Chief Justice has referred
right.
to. Some will calculate, well, maybe I can win this case, I'll go for the curative, and then I'll have an issue on appeal.
Right.
They do that.
I agree.
But at the end of the day,
sometimes
they
win.
At the end of the day, I think your argument, as I'm hearing, there's some cases where the prejudice is so overwhelming, despite that strategic maneuvering, the defendant had a right to a fair trial.
Correct. And I think this court obviously is the ultimate, you know, overseer of that.
I think your answer to my question was yes. It may not sound right, but I, the defense attorney, am entitled to do that. I'm entitled. I may get a different standard of review if I wait until later to ask for a new trial instead of asking a mistrial now, but that's what I understand your argument to be.
I think you're right, Your Honor. I think the answer is yes. I wouldn't really say about the defense attorney, but I think ultimately it's the defendant doesn't lose his right to an appellate review of some sort on that error.
But he's acting at his peril because
because
the court will more rigorously review the record.
That's how I would look at it, and that's how I think the case law talks about it. You know, I think the only other thing I would say, I know I don't want to take up too much more of the court's time, is that, you know, again, and I know the defense lawyers didn't object, but again, this whole thing was set in motion by this overly detailed opening statement, which in and of itself is inconsistent, at least with the language of the court's prior precedent, not only in our state, but in other states. It's an outline. They didn't need to go into the details of what the Green said to the Green. I mean, it was, you put the ball out there, and then, of course, when she didn't testify, it's devastating evidence. Devastating comment.
Well, there were a series of events that preceded that, that you know, obviously you've tried a lot of cases, criminal cases. I would have shaken your head no.
I'm an appeal lawyer.
Appeal lawyer, okay. Too much fun to be here with us, right?
That's right.
But the series of events that occurred here, where you have a witness giving a statement, recanting, and then this kind of strange the lawyer making a representation, and then the client acting inconsistently with the lawyer's representation, ultimately spending 3 weeks in jail,
yeah.
Right? That's an unusual series.
Oh, I agree. I totally agree with Your Honor. And again, I don't think the prosecutor acted in bad faith at all. I think they tried the best they could. They thought the grandmother was going to testify. But there's still objective evidence in the record that was kind of putting these warning lights up that this was a risk that she might not get up there and actually talk and might just be like, I'm not talking.
So if the prosecutor acted in good faith based on what she knew,
yeah.
As of the date of the opening,
yeah.
Is there an error at all?
Yes. I still think there's an error because the issue then still becomes, even if they didn't do it intentionally, there are other things that happen at a trial that cause an error in the fairness. Like, for example, sometimes a witness blurts something out that the prosecutor isn't aware of and goes, well, this man sexually assaulted me, just for example, on another time. I know this guy. That's going to cause a mistrial. It's not the prosecutor's fault, but there are errors that the prosecutor didn't do something intentionally.
You could have a case, for example, where you have a detailed opening about damning evidence that a witness will present, and the witness passes from natural causes before being called to the stand. You still have to go through this analysis.
Precisely. If the court has any further questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you for hearing the case, Your Honor.
Mr. Silver.
Good afternoon, Justices. I'm going to argue something that I have not heard argued in this argument, and that is the Confrontation Clause. In Article 1, Paragraph 10 of the New Jersey Constitution, the Sixth Amendment of the United States Constitution requires a reversal in this case because it's pretty clear that there was prejudicial, unconfronted testimonial evidence, and yes, it's evidence when it comes from the prosecutor in the opening statement. It's testimonial evidence according to Justice Scalia in Crawford versus Washington. So that evidence presented was plain and it was incurable. Here's what the prosecutor told the jury that Mrs. Smith would testify to. That her grandson admitted to her that he had fired the fatal shot, and this is a murder with one shot. So he fired the fatal shot, which is pretty key evidence in a murder by a single gunshot. Then she reinforced the truth of her testimony by giving a recorded statement confirming that her grandson fired the fatal shot. And then, and this is Justice Alvin's point, the rest of this opening is completely wrong. It's objectionable. I mean, the prosecutor then starts to vouch for the credibility of the witness. Even though Mrs. Smith is biased in favor of Green, she loves him, she's offering damaging admission to law enforcement. She's so conflicted because, and this was the quote, she's stuck between the love of her grandson and testifying in court. This implies, and I think the jury can infer, that she might not show up because she's so conflicted and because she would have to testify and testify about her grandson's guilt. So when she doesn't show up, that guilt is fully corroborated when she doesn't testify. It compounds the problem, and all because of this illegal, or I should say unethical opening where the prosecutor is vouching for the credibility of the witness. And then let's talk about the fact that the defendant is not able to confront that testimony, that testimonial evidence, I should say. And truthfully, a defense lawyer could do a pretty good job confronting it, because he's talking about, look, the state only wants to get her on the stand so they can get the tape in. They don't really want her testimony. They want the tape recorded evidence beforehand.
Counsel, could you point out to me the part where he's vouching for your grandmother's? Could you point out to me the part of the opening where he's vouching for the grandmother's credibility?
Sure. When the prosecutor says that she loves her grandson, she's torn between. That's vouching for the credibility, because what it says to the jury is, this is a witness who doesn't want to harm the defendant, but she's going to do it anyway. That carries an additional imprimatur of truth, which is exactly that. That's vouching for the credibility of the witness.
The state explains that by saying that they were expecting a hostile witness on the stand.
Yeah, they did explain that, and truthfully, I don't know how the court takes that, but that's probably as lame an explanation as I've heard, given the words that are said in there. But even so, that's a proper opening.
Counsel, and another point earlier on, he asked about when you assess her credibility, you're corroborating evidence. Is she telling the truth? Does it jive with other evidence to corroborate with other people? Isn't that the standard jury charge regarding the credibility?
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understood that.
When he is earlier, before that, talks about the difficult position, he says, when you're assessing her credibility, I may actually use corroborating evidence. Ask yourself, is what Mrs. Smith telling is credible? Does it jive with other evidence? Is it corroborated by other people? Isn't that the standard jury charge on credibility?
Yeah, but it doesn't cure the other parts where he is explaining to the jury why it is her testimony should be more credible, because she loves her grandson and she's still incriminating him. And that's the kind of thing that is, if you're arguing to the jury, that's the kind of thing that you would trumpet, because that really makes your witness incredibly believable, that she loves her grandson and she's still saying this terrible thing about him. So, that's really dynamite testimony.
Well, yeah, what grandmother would incriminate her grandson unless it was true?
Maybe mine. But you're denied the right of cross-examination. You can show that she's going to tell the jury if the defendant is allowed the confrontation. She'll tell the jury, not true, I lied because I was trying to help him.
How does your argument about the confrontation clause square with what juries are told every day? Opening and closing statements are not evidence.
Because if what is told the jury is testimonial, and that's the real critical part of Justice Scalia's argument. If it doesn't matter whether it comes from the witness stand or whether it's under oath, if the jury gets testimonial evidence that cannot be or has not been confronted, it's a violation of the Confrontation Clause. And what Crawford is all about is to take out the rule of evidence, to take out the reliability factor that we had in Ohio, in Ohio versus Roberts. And what Justice Scalia says is that relying on the law of evidence dilutes the power of the Confrontation Clause. And so, and I was saying that
talking about in Crawford, he was talking about letting hearsay evidence in under a hearsay rule dilutes the Confrontation Clause.
No, actually, I think what Justice Scalia was saying in Crawford was the prior law, the rationale,
right,
for the Confrontation Clause relied upon the law of evidence, so that
right.
In Ohio versus
Roberts, you and I
were
saying the same
right.
thing.
And what he says is you can't do that, because it just dilutes the Confrontation Clause, and what's the sine qua non of the Confrontation Clause is cross-examination.
Right, but you're making a different point with this.
Well, is there case law that supports the argument you're making that an opening statement not followed through should be tossed, should generate a mistrial on grounds of confrontation?
Let me parse that if I can. Yes, there is certainly, Justice Scalia says clearly, that the statement from the prosecutor in the opening, from a police officer at the scene that he relates, is testimonial evidence. Now we have some other things. If you get past it, I'll get to your answer in 1 second, but I think it'd be more clear if I do this. So if we say that the prosecutor clearly gave testimonial evidence, and if we say there's no difference between sworn testimony and the unsworn testimony for confrontation purposes, and certainly that's Justice Scalia's holding in Crawford, then you get to the violation. Then there's some hurdles that have to be cured, and that's why I'm fumfering a little bit with your question, Chief Justice. And that is, you've got to get past what Justice Albin wrote in Roberts, where in Roberts it was simply he didn't make the objection. The Confrontation Clause doesn't raise itself. You got to make an objection to it, and the answer to that, I think, that's one. The second is the curative instruction, and the third is harmless error. Those are the three things only. One of those three things has to defeat this Confrontation Clause problem, because it's clear that there was testimonial evidence in that was not confronted. There was no cross-examination. So one of those three, the only way that this is, that the conviction is upheld and the appellate division is reversed, if we go to the jurisprudence of the Confrontation Clause, is either it's not objected to, or it's waived, is actually the way Justice Albin phrased it, in that it's either waived or it's harmless error or it's cured by the instruction.
If we take your argument to its logical conclusion, at the end of the opening statement, defense counsel can stand up and say, Your Honor, that was evidence, that was testimonial, I object on Confrontation Clause grounds.
No,
which really doesn't make sense, because, and tell me why I'm mistaken.
Because
the violation kicks in when you don't have a witness take the stand and present that testimony.
That
short of that, do you have a confrontation?
The objection doesn't, no, you don't have the objection, or the issue doesn't ripen until the state rests and she hasn't testified. Because, and truthfully, even though she's taking the contempt and she's in jail, she has the power to cure that contempt and come in and testify. So the issue of raising the objection doesn't happen until the state rests, and that's when the issue ripens. And it seems to me, I think I'll do it this way. This October, it'll be 55 years that I've been practicing. In that period of time, almost all my practice has been criminal defense law, some prosecution law too. But in those 55 years, the two most important constitutional criminal law decisions that we've ever had were Apprendi and Crawford. So what bothers me is we have a confrontation issue where nobody mentions the confrontation. And it's the most important, you know, it's a pillar of understanding how to defend people and how to enforce criminal defense rights.
So was it waived in this case?
Well, I think that's the issue, and I would go to Justice Albin's language from Roberts, where he says, and I think this is the fact, there may be some instances where the failure to object is so patently unreasonable, so clearly erroneous, that no rational counsel acting within the wide range of professional norms would pursue such a course. In those instances, the trial court, or this court, may take notice of any error of such a nature as been clearly capable of producing unjust results, even though such error was not brought to the attention by a party.
Is this argument being made by the defendant as we sit here today?
That's a hard question to answer, because nobody, until I got up, has started into the jurisprudence of the Confrontation Clause, but there's certainly arguments that are made that could fit into that.
You could fit the same facts in there, but
yes.
I'm looking at the briefs, we've heard the arguments. Is this an argument that's being raised by an amicus, not raised by a party?
Yes.
And we don't hear those generally.
Well, right? At least from the standpoint of the Organized Criminal Defense Bar that I'm here as a representative of, we're hoping that this court will take this occasion to do what Justice Scalia did, and that is to breathe some life back into the Confrontation Clause. I mean, take State versus Land. That's a Confrontation Clause case where nobody mentions it.
It's really implicit in your co-counsel's arguments, because we're talking about an opening statement that is hearsay. No one testifies to it. So, and hearsay itself has a confrontation. Even before there was a Confrontation Clause, the whole purpose of not permitting hearsay was to allow attorneys to confront the evidence against them. So it's implicit.
And certainly Justice Scalia goes back into ancient history to show how important cross-examination is to the Confrontation Clause. And that's what he is talking about in it, and it's that that doesn't seem to be part of the warp and woof of the cases where it should be. And so that is one of the things that we are really hoping, we as the organized criminal defense bar, is that this court will get into the Confrontation Clause and, you know, reaffirm the jurisprudence of Justice Scalia. And then when we get to the three possibilities, I think that in terms of the invitation or the waiver, I think that, you know, you can't waive something like this. You can't. And the next thing that happens is a PCR on ineffective assistance of counsel.
You can't waive a confrontation clause argument? You can't waive a confrontation clause argument?
No, you can. But I say in this particular case where the lawyer doesn't even mention the confrontation clause, does not seem aware that this is a confrontation clause issue, and where the testimony is so dramatically prejudicial, where it is testimonial, and that's the question Justice Fernandez-Vinas was talking about, evidence, it may not be evidence in a hearsay issue, but it is evidence in the jurisprudence of the Confrontation Clause, and that's one of the reasons that I would hope to focus this court in on the Confrontation Clause rather than just the fairness arguments of Land and in fact, even the appellate division.
Well, if you don't, focus us in this time, you certainly made an effective argument on PCR.
Well, it seems to me that this is a direct appeal.
Oh, no, it definitely is a direct appeal
and,
here.
And the issue is,
I'll give you that.
The facts are squarely raised by the issue here. And may I put one other point for Justice Patterson? Justice Patterson has reported, the lawyer did say, get the order and the witness will testify. But that seems to be not really taking into effect the whole of the situation. What we got from Mrs. Smith, clearly, is she wants to help her grandson. She's sorry she gave a statement, and she wants to help her grandson. The only thing that the prosecutor wants out of Mrs. Smith is for her to, it doesn't matter what she says, the prosecutor just wants to play the tape. The only way Mrs. Smith has to defeat that is to not show up and not testify. So for the prosecutor to not be aware that that was a possibility is bordering on reckless.
Not so suggesting that it wasn't a possibility. There are a lot of different possibilities.
Well,
but you have a lawyer very late in a very lengthy process about this, at the conclusion of a court hearing, making a representation that with immunity, she's going to testify. Right.
Well,
their possibilities are she doesn't disregard this advice. She does all kinds of things. But
lawyers have made lots of representations that their clients have undercut them by not following through.
True.
And all I'm saying in this case is that anybody would understand that there is some possibility and that the prosecutor, if he could produce the evidence, fine. But why put it in the opening when you might not be able to? And that's part of where I think this issue goes.
I think we have your position. Is there anything you wanted to close with?
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Paskowitz, rebuttal?
Your Honors, defense counsel and amicus made much of sort of the argument, and I think their arguments are really premised on the idea that jurors are completely incapable of following the court's express instructions regarding what is appropriately before them, that for all we know, they're out there considering, they know the state has great power, despite the fact that they're told by the courts exactly what to consider, and that all the evidence put before them, the evidence in the trial by the parties, not the arguments of counsel, might be considered, and who knows, for all we know, I mean, there was also, a statement made by co-defendant Holliday that was suppressed. Maybe they somehow considered that too, because we don't know what jurors consider. They just know the state has great power, and if they say something, that must be the case. There's no evidence here. There's no evidence that the jury did not follow the court's instructions in this case. Any of them, all of them.
But we have said, the U.S. Supreme Court has said in Bruton, in a case where a confession came in against the co-defendant, despite the instructions that the court gives, the jurors cannot engage in the type of mental gymnastics necessary to disregard what they heard. We've said that there are certain errors that are just so prejudicial that no instruction can possibly cure the error. We've So the United States Supreme Court has said that, right?
In the case of evidence, not in the case of an opening statement that the jury specifically told isn't evidence. And I think, and Justice Patterson raised this issue a number of times, and I think it has to be part of the standard, is reasonableness. I'm not looking to get into an argument about post-conviction relief or anything else, but in repeatedly questioning why did defense counsel and sort of talking about mental gymnastics, why might defense counsel not have objected at a certain point? Why might defense counsel not have moved for a mistrial? Engaging in mental gymnastics would be because, oh, it's this great strategic decision or it's not, but it might just be that what's plain is plain and that at the time at which the parties opened, everyone, not just the state, reasonably believed that Mrs. Smith was going to appear and testify. Counsel, particularly for Mr. Green, objected twice during the state's opening statement. There's no question that throughout trial she was a strenuous advocate for Mr. Green.
But even if that's so, assume there's good faith all around on this issue, you still have to deal with the fact that the jury heard a very detailed, damning statement.
And I would respectfully submit, Your Honors, and I think this is the ultimate argument from the state, that when one looks at the continuum of cases between the United States Supreme Court's decision in Cupp, in which the state, in an opening statement, indicated that a co-defendant who had already pled guilty was going to testify and didn't, and the defendant twice moved for a mistrial, and the court opined not only that there was not prosecutorial misconduct, there was also not a violation of the Confrontation Clause, and they said at least where the anticipated but unproduced evidence is not touted to the jury as a crucial part of the prosecution's case, it's hard for us to imagine that the minds of jurors would be so influenced by such incidental statements during this long trial that they would not appraise the evidence objectively and dispassionately. From the state's perspective, that describes this case. At the other end of the continuum is Land, which required the state to amend its entire theory of the case. There were eight things that the assistant prosecutor in Land referenced that it was unable to, that the state was unable to produce. And the state's case at the close of that case was premised upon an entirely different theory, entirely different set of facts than it was at the outset. Perhaps most instructive on this, maybe even more so factually than Land, is Walden. Walden isn't simply a matter of the state referencing a witness it failed to produce in a vacuum. There was alleged additional error. There was the fact that the assistant prosecutor ultimately had the opportunity at near the close of the state's case to call the witness it hadn't produced and just decided not to. And I'm not going to belabor these cases, but on the continuum of cases...
How about the case of Brown versus Superintendent Green SCI, Third Circuit case? Are you familiar with that?
I'm not.
Because you mentioned Frazier, I'm just going to quote, that Frazier made clear that not all mistakes in opening or closing statements are Bruton violations, but it never said or even implied that Bruton has a backdoor that allows prosecutors to do what the Supreme Court has expressly forbidden, dangle an incriminating statement in front of jurors, tell them it implicates a particular defendant, and then expect that they will not use it against that person. I mean, so that's what the Third Circuit has said.
And I think to some extent that goes to my point, which is there's a continuum of conduct, and Land and Walden and Torres are here, and Cupp is here, and so is the case at Barr. And in a case where it certainly seems that all of the parties expected that Mrs. Smith was going to testify, and it wasn't the state's, it wasn't that the state didn't care if Mrs. Smith was going to testify because they just wanted her out of court statement. It had to deal with the reality, which was the potential that she might recant and they'd have to use her out-of-court statement. Under all of the circumstances, and including reasonableness as part of that analysis, right down to the fact that not only did Mrs. Smith not have to testify, all she had to do was be sworn. What occurred in this case was not capable of producing an unjust result, and the conviction should be reinstated.
Thank you. Thank you to counsel for the very fine argument. We'll take the matter under advisement. Court is in recess.